because we bootstrapped, everything we built had to be justifiable that it was going to make some money for us. Really, you have to understand the real challenges for a customer, because you better build it, spend your time and money on it, and then they have to pay for it.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, my guest is Vinny Breslin. Vinny and his co-founders bootstrapped their startup, Uplisting, to turn over annual recurring revenues of $3 million per year, and they were processing over $400 million per year for their clients until they sold just a couple of months ago. This is their story of how they bootstrapped at that number and how they sold. This is a remote working masterclass. It was a couple of years into the startup before Vinny even met up with his co-founders. Here's my chat with Vinny Breslin. Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish businesses who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to become more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the bio below. Okay, you know me. You know I'm massively into my health, fitness, and training. But there's one thing I haven't spoken about before, and that is a product I take every single day. It's a product called Resilience, and it's made by an Irish company called Ethos. What's kind of funny is that every single entrepreneur I meet, that is the one characteristic they have, incredible resilience. So I like that little play on words. It's a multifunctional supplement that supports cognitive function, immunity, which is super important this time of year, energy levels, and it keeps stress at bay. I also love it because it's easy. If you're bringing anything new habit into your life, it has to be easy, and taking Resilience is so simple. I simply mix it in a glass of water every single morning, and I always throw a couple of extra in my gym bag to keep them with me. It's a really tasty blood orange flavor as well. It ticks all the boxes. It has B vitamins, amino acids, vitamin C, and adaptogens like reishi mushroom and ashwagandha. So, if you want to try it, I think you should. Go to weareethos.com. And because I like it so much, the guys have given me a discount code. So if you go to weareethos.com, enter Gary Fox at the checkout, you'll get 20% off, which makes taking resilience about €1 a day, which is an unbelievable price for building some inner resilience. Check out weareethos.com. If you've been listening for a while, you'll know Iconic Offices has been my partner and home in the pod for a long time now. Working and recording in their spaces has helped support the ambitious goals of the pod, and to be honest, really helped it grow. So I partner with them to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, the opportunity to work from Iconic Offices spaces and experience it for yourself. No fees, no catches. Simply visit the Iconic Offices link in the show notes below and enter the code GARY24 and claim your free co-working day pass, or bring the whole team with you and book a day office.
Vinny, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And you're joining me from lovely Lisbon today.
Sunny, pretty sunny Lisbon today, yes.
I'm slightly jealous. It's a very rainy, stormy Wicklow today.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons for Lisbon. It's like, I think my mood is overinfluenced by the weather. So here we are.
It's huge. I was only literally making a coffee this morning in the dark, and I was like, I'd love just some brightness. We went to Spain during the summer for 5 weeks, and it was just crazy. Like the difference it has on your mood, and it's wild. So you recently moved to Lisbon?
Yeah, we moved October last year. So fairly, very new, still fresh. I think we were still in move mode, I guess, until Christmas. Been home for Christmas and then come back in the new year, and it's now settled in and getting used to life here. We moved from New York with 5 years before we moved here.
Nice. And why Lisbon? Lots of reasons, but tell me why.
Yeah, loads of reasons. Close to home, weather is really a big one. It's a really safe city. It's got a good tech scene. It's not, loads of good restaurants and outdoor lifestyle. And then one of the most important things is we have quite a few friends here, which is a big difference.
A lot of people moved there,
all of those above,
during COVID and kind of before COVID. I think a lot of people were starting to kind of identify it as a really good spot to move. There seems to be a buzz in tech scene down there, and especially a big Irish expat scene.
There is, yeah. I haven't actually been, I haven't got involved in it yet. I'll definitely check some of the events out, and we're continually to look for new people to hang out with. So yeah, I haven't got involved in it yet, but there definitely is a vibe here.
ironically, when you're too busy actually working, you don't get involved in the scene, which is probably no bad thing.
Exactly.
You built Uplisting. People will be familiar with that from, it's just made the news very, very recently. The Currency did a super piece on it about the sale. So can you just give us a fill in on what Uplisting is?
We build software for, or we power the hospitality industry, and in particular short-term rentals. We process around $400 million in bookings last year for our users, and we did about $60 million through Stripe. So that's like direct bookings through Stripe. And basically what Uplisting is, it is a platform that allows you to run and automate your short-term rental business. And typically our customers have, you know, between 5 and 500 properties that they live inside Uplisting. And like one of the easiest ways to explain what it does is if you have one property on Airbnb, you know, that's all good. If you have one property on Airbnb and booking.com and Vrbo and Google vacation rentals, then it's actually quite challenging to keep things in sync and have the right prices in each platform. And then if you multiply that by 5 or 10 or 500, it's actually impossible to run your business by just being on those platforms and using their infrastructure. So what Uplisting does is it's a central location where you run your business from. We are an Airbnb software partner. We're Google software partner, booking.com, Vrbo. So you change things in Uplisting, then we sync out to each platform. So our customers don't really go on to the Airbnb website, for example. They would run their business through our software.
Yeah, I'm intimately familiar with all this platform and software. We used to manage 70 Airbnbs in Dublin. And the complexity, like you explained beautifully there, like when you have one, you're like, oh, it's a lot of questions. When you have five, you're like, oh my God, if someone else asks me about the TV remote, I'm going to actually just scream.
We do.
So like the automation part of things is huge. I often used to think of it as, it was like having an extra 1.5 to 2 staff members. It was phenomenal. Like you couldn't run a business without it.
Yeah. And one thing we find with our customers is they're like, you know, they're hustling. A lot of them have a full-time job or something else. This is not necessarily their focus. So they're obsessed with automation. Like they need this business to run in their spare time and to continue to run when they're doing their other job. Automation has just been so important to everything that we've provided, and we're just constantly adding new ways to automate some aspect of your business.
Like a lot of businesses try automate just for automate's sake, like with AI and stuff now. Everybody's an AI company all of a sudden. But with property management and with Airbnb and short-term rentals, like it cannot be done without it, without that kind of ease of automation. There's so many things you do in a day that happen every single day and multiple times a day. We might have 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 check-ins in a day. And then you reverse that round, and then 2 days later, you're checking them out. There's just so many logistical things. And what was interesting is we did loads of tests with automation and remote check-in and things like that. And people love it. Once they're getting the information, people don't really mind where it's coming from, as long as it's in an efficient way. Where did this idea come from?
Yeah, good question. We, so myself, Andy and Taddy, we're the three co-founders, or three founders of Uplisting. We met at an Airbnb competitor called Housetrip in London in, I think, 2016. So Housetrip were, you know, they raised about $70, $80 million. They were competing as Airbnb, who had raised like $1 billion at that time. But they had lots of hosts, and it was quite early on in the short-term rental kind of industry in the market. I kind of spent hundreds of hours talking to customers. I was all doing like lots of customer development or user development, I guess, from through Housetrip hosts who were like individual hosts with multiple properties. And there was clearly a need to have a platform to help you manage your business. It was really impossible to sync across like Housetrip and Airbnb and Book.com and whatever else at that time. So there was clear need for software like Uplisting, and Housetrip got acquired by TripAdvisor, Andy and Taddy kind of left TripAdvisor and started Uplisting from scratch late 2017, kind of early 2018. And we started up as very much a side project. We had our own kind of full-time jobs or contracting for the first couple of years of the business.
So you'd seen this problem, like you'd seen customers go, yeah, this is great, but. So you'd seen this occurring again and again and again. So you decided, right, we'll just go for it.
Yeah. So like if you're looking even from a house trips perspective, you know, Airbnb is the market leader there. Everybody trusted their Airbnb calendar and they weren't updating their house trip calendar or changing prices or having the right availability. So what would happen would be that a guest would book on house trip and they'd have to cancel that reservation because it was already booked on Airbnb. So like a really, there's both from the booking site perspective and the user perspective, there was a real need for, you know, some sort of software to sync things together.
And people always go where the demand is. If you're getting 80% of your bookings from one place, just with the best will in the world, it just falls away, you know, because it's such a labor intensive business as it was. So what was your plan when you set it up? Like, what were you thinking? Okay, this is what our goal is going to be. Did you have a plan?
Yeah, a rough plan. Like, we didn't, you know, necessarily go and work out our TAM or any of that kind of stuff that you put in as pitch deck typically. So we were like, look, there's a business there. There's a lot of potential customers. It's a growing market. We can definitely build a sustainable small business that, you know, that see where it goes. So the plan was to try and get to, the original plan was to try and get to like $15,000 monthly recurring revenue, and then see if we should go and raise some money. Basically, that was our, you know, initial plan.
And how did you build it?
So Andy and Tade are the engineers. And this is kind of a difference that I, with Up This Thing, that I didn't have in my first startup, where we didn't have any engineers in the team. So with Up This Thing, it was like completely different. So we were like, Andy and Tade are, you know, world-class engineers. I did design and front-end stuff, and then every other aspect of the business, like sales. So we, like, as you have to do. So it was, my main job was to do as much of the stuff that I could, as much of the non-engineering stuff as possible, so that the two lads were not distracted and were just sitting down at a computer.
I get you.
And building a product all day long. That was like my entire role. So we built it evenings, weekends. We'd have like a Sunday product call for like 3 hours every Sunday for years before we could afford to actually employ ourselves kind of on a regular basis and not have to work other jobs. But we built it. We built, like, you know, very much a bare bones initial solution, which was just a simple iCal syncing, which you'd be familiar with, but, you know, isn't anything complicated. And we got our, you know, our first customer like at the beginning of 2017, I think it was. He was paying like $10 a month in Canada for just a very simple calendar syncing solution.
Where did they come from? How did you find them? So that's always the interesting one. The first like 5 to 10 customers is always fascinating for me. It's like, where did you find them?
Yeah, I think that was, we did some like cold emails at the time. That was, so we'd, you know, scour the internet for property management companies or wherever you could find somebody that your potential customer or prospect is, and did some emails around that. That was maybe our first customer. The vast majority of our, maybe probably our first 200 customers came from Facebook groups, where kind of client lived. So there was a lot of, like Airbnbs and short-term rentals in general, there's a lot of, people getting into the industry that don't have any background in it at all. You know, it's fairly new. Still is fairly new even today.
It attracts all sorts. It does.
It attracts all sorts.
A lot of characters, as you say in Ireland. A lot of characters.
Yeah, a lot of characters. But there's like support groups almost. You know, they are support groups, yeah. I guess, where they all congregate on Facebook. And I would be there all day long. Answering all of the questions, not about software, and then every so often, like, you know, linking in a little uplisting link or something.
Love it.
Just not spamming, basically.
Yeah.
It was from genuinely the first, you know, 100 customers came from, majority came from like Facebook groups.
That's a great hack though, isn't it? Not even a hack, it's just a great idea. It's just like provide tons and tons of value and then have an ask every so often.
Be trusted. Yeah, be trusted. And then, you know, you just get that flywheel of people recommending you. You know, you're fairly, it's a growing market, there's not much software in there, it's extremely competitive now, like extremely competitive. Back then it wasn't a lot of software
really.
So you were like, you know, you were known as the software to use, or one of the software three, I guess, software to use.
It shows the value though, intimately knowing your customer and intimately knowing your market. Totally. You just had spent the hours and you knew that this is where they hang out. I think a lot of people who go searching for a problem to solve as opposed to having a problem they need to solve, I think that's the big difference you see with founders.
Yeah, totally. Entirely just, you know, talking to customers, understanding their problems. And then because we bootstrapped, everything we built had to you know, be justifiable that it was going to make some money for us. So you have to understand the real challenges for a customer, because you've got to build it, spend your time and money on it, and then they have to pay for it. So you need to know it intimately.
Give me the timeline here. So when did you start it, and when did you get your first customer?
So I think probably the first code, you know, line of code was probably autumn 2016, and then 2017, probably I think January 2017 was my first customer. And then it was like, if you're looking at the line of revenue growth over time, it was like a flat line for about 12 months, and then slowly.
That's quick though, from code to customer. That's pretty fast.
Yeah, decent. You know, something like $10 a month. You're like, you get that first Stripe kind of alert that you've got a customer. Like, oh, okay, great. We're onto something. Let's keep on going.
Yeah, it may as well be 10,000 though, because that first buzz is like, oh wow, we're not crazy. Yeah.
You're caught chasing that forevermore.
Yeah, it's class. So talk to me then about, because you bootstrapped this with two other co-founders. What was the idea behind bootstrapping and not doing the traditional, like, oh, we're going to raise X amount? Because you'd obviously seen that with Housetrip.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one reason. You know, we saw companies like Housetrip spending like $1 million a month on Google Ads, and it's just not sustainable. Wow. It's like, this doesn't make any sense, you know. But, you know, there's lots of reasons. But for me personally, it was, I don't like going out and convincing people that I'm worth putting money into. Like, that was, it's not enjoyable anyway. And it's demoralizing, and having to prove yourself. Like, I didn't go to Harvard or Stanford or any of those kind of names where you get a foot in the door. So it was either, you know, you're either, when you're thinking about running a business, a startup, you're either spending the majority of your time in the early days going out and raising money, or just build the business. And I was much more comfortable in just building the business, like head down in the room, talk to customers, build a product, and see how far we can get to from there. And that's kind of the initial reason to do Bootstrapped. And it was that idea of not having to convince people. And at some point in time, we would get to a revenue point where we could go to a VC and say, we've proven ourselves. We're now at $15,000 ever, or whatever it is. Mm. Let's talk about investing. But the longer we went on, the less need we had to raise money. And there was like invoice-based financing came along. So we were taking that on board to serve our kind of capital and cash needs.
How does that work?
Basically, you know, when you have a SaaS company, you have your recurring revenue, and there are platforms out there like Capchase, for example, who will give you a loan effectively, or will buy your future revenue. So, you know, you could go and get, if you're doing, I don't know, $20,000 a month, they'll give you $100,000 and you'd pay that back over 12 months effectively.
Okay. So your customers were paying month on month, is it? And they'd kind of like forecast out how much they reckon. What about churn and things like that?
Yeah, all factored in. Our churn was like really low anyway, like under, you know, 2% generally. But yeah, they'd factor all of that in before they give you any money.
And how did you charge like just a monthly fee and then a percentage, or is it just a flat fee?
Primarily, most of the life of the company was just a monthly subscription or annual if you wanted to. More recently, we've been taking a bit of a percentage. So we take a cut of Google Vacation Rental Booking, for example, and that's 3%. And we are like releasing upsells feature where you can sell, you know, early check-in, the checkout, and we'll take like a cut of that as well. But primarily, it's just monthly subscription.
I like that. The upsells is a great idea, actually, because that was one thing we often felt very constrained within the platform, because sometimes, like, you know, you want to stick within the platform for a multitude of reasons. But then there was times when you're kind of doing these other things and you're trying to having to hack your way around it, going, I'll arrange a transfer for the airport for them, but then I'm going to have to ring him, and then he rings them, and then they're ringing you. It was all very, so you could see the, like, I think even still today, it's still probably, as you say, it's a very young industry.
Mm. Yeah, which, you know, seems funny to say, but it really is. This, you know, we're nowhere near the top of this market.
I think so, and it's interesting. Like with Airbnb, like when I started, Airbnb was the hot, sexy thing. It was like, oh wow, this amazing platform is helping people pay their mortgage. It's bringing tourists. And then around 2019, there was a real shift in the winds. There was like a cooling towards Airbnb, a massive cooling, especially in Dublin. There was a huge, huge cooling towards it, and it actually made doing business extremely tough. and they've brought in like a lot of strict rules around it now. How did that affect your business, or did it?
It didn't at all for us. We have like 1,500 customers, maybe a few more now, but we don't really. A lot of our business is vacation rental, so it's not the urban kind of vacation rental or urban short-term rental that would be impacted necessarily by the regulations and such. But yeah, we haven't noticed. I mean, it's probably because we're not, you know, significantly big enough to have for that to make an impact on our business, but it hasn't been an issue for us. We have definitely like churned customers every now and again because of a regulation coming in, but it hasn't had a, you know, materially big impact on us.
How do you see the short-term rental playing out? Because I'm kind of like you, I'm quite bullish on it still. I think we're still very early. Like, how do you see it kind of playing out over the next kind of 5 years?
Yeah, I think there's so many interesting, like watching our customers, what they're doing. So we have lots of customers who start off short-term rentals, obviously, and are now kind of branching into hotels or more traditional hospitality and taking the learnings from short-term rentals into hotels, whether it's like automated check-ins and, you know, those things, those kind of facilities or automations that the short-term rental customer is obsessed with, and just introducing those into hotels. I think it's really interesting. There's definitely like this merging of those two industries of short-term rentals and traditional hospitality. And this is just like this huge, you know, middle of Venn diagram of gray area, new things coming out. We don't know what's, you know, there's so many different opportunities there for the market to evolve into. Like there's other examples. I was talking to somebody recently in the States, and in the States you have like multifamily units as the, you know, the big apartment blocks, and they were building multifamily units, but they're like, as part of the design process, they'd have maybe 100 multifamily units and then 10 purpose-built Airbnbs, for example, or short-term rentals. So, you know, the fact that the built environment is now, you know, working towards having short-term rentals as part of the infrastructure, I think is really interesting as well. So there's so many different areas I think that the market can go into. So I'm excited to see what does happen.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think Airbnb have also done quite well. I think after post-COVID, I think there was like a real expectation that this would like it was kind of the end of days for Airbnb. There, people were like, oh, COVID's going to finish it off now. And what they did, like the amount of product updates they pushed and how they evolved was, I think it's a business masterclass in how they evolved their offering.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Like so much admiration for Airbnb and how it's run and the way that they do business. And for us, it was a similar situation during COVID. You know, when it first occurred, we were like, okay, we're dead. This is gone now. there goes that idea. But for the first few months, we kind of gave our customers just free subscriptions. And because we were quite lean, it didn't really impact us. We were like, let's just keep it lean. We'll not pay ourselves for a couple of months and try and push through this. We didn't know how long it was going to last, obviously. But by October of that year, of 2020, I think, the short-term rental market was just booming. Like we were growing 8% month on month, and we grew 8% month on month from that month on, you know, pretty much until
wow.
Just from people, you know, going, wanting to escape the city, and especially in the US, like there wasn't that much lockdown. It was more people wanted to leave the city to just get away from, you know, COVID and whatever else. Like me and my wife, our son and our friends, we went to Pennsylvania for a month in the middle of nowhere just to avoid COVID. So it was very common. So yeah, the business kind of boomed during COVID, and it continues to.
Which is fascinating because like during the time you just didn't know what was going to happen. And then, you know, there was unexpected things. And it's a great lesson in business too, isn't it? Like it's like you just never know what's going to happen for good and for bad. Like, and just being able to ride it out. There's a lot of lessons there about being in charge of your own destiny in terms of as a business owner. If you were VC funded and you had big, big targets and big, big expectations, being able to make those decisions might have been tough. Was that part of the reason why you didn't go for VC funding?
Yeah, it is a reason. You know, I think the challenge, like I always say, it's like staying in the game is the hardest part of this. It's like you got to keep whatever you can do to stay alive is like you just have to do it. Because eventually, I think I've definitely seen it through uplisting where over the years, there is like a natural organic kind of momentum behind a business that just survives for a certain amount of time. I think I can't put my finger on what that is or if anybody's done studies on this or whatever, but whether it's the brand name becomes more well known or you're trusted or you're building up customers, you know, over time, staying in the game is just, I think, the most important thing for a business. But VC, like, we were looking at our competitors. Some of our competitors have raised hundreds of millions of dollars. So we're competing against these, you know, huge companies. And when COVID did hit, and some of those were based on percentage bookings and not on a subscription model. So like their whole revenue would just go to, not to zero, but massively, massively drop. So at that time, we were looking at our competitors thinking, we can probably outlast them here. So let's just, you know, knuckle down and see how long we can survive, basically. I guess looking back, it's fortunate to not have VC funding, but maybe not, we couldn't have foreseen that happening, I guess.
So the options of being bootstrapped, like, was that something, as that developed, like, was that exactly what you expected? Was it better, or did you have any regrets?
Options, no regrets. Options were, I think, are just extremely important in running a business and generally in life, I think. You want to give yourselves as many options as possible when you're running a business. And a good example of that is the VC capital. Not that I'm against raising VC money at all. I think as I mentioned, it's a personal thing. I didn't think that I was in a position to raise money from top tier investors when we started up listing. So that was a decision. That was a reason why, or one of the reasons why we bootstrapped. But having the option, you know, you need to think carefully about what you want to do. So if you go out and raise VC money early on in your, in the life of the business, then your only real successful outcome is to sell that business for, you know, 150 million plus. That's how you're going to have a successful personal, you know, for you. When you've removed the option of achieving a successful exit for a business that you own 100% of or 90% of, whatever it is, for 10 million or 20 or 30 or, you know, 50. Or just having a really nice cash flowing business, you've removed those options by having VC capital, which I think is, you know, something to definitely consider before you go down that route.
Why do so many people not consider that? Like, why is there this rush towards funding, or why is there a perceived rush towards funding, I should say?
Yeah, I think, like, in my first business, which was called Shansplan, I had a software business with my mom. That was my first kind of jump into it. I don't know, you reading TechCrunch and, you know, other publications, and for reason it seems to be the only way to run business. Like, it's all geared towards let's go out and raise some money and, you know, go large. I think that's a big reason why. We only really see successes from, you know, VC, you know, raising money is a success. At least the way, you know, from what we see in these publications. And we don't really hear a lot of stories about companies that just get their head down and obviously there's a load of these businesses that aren't in the tech world. The whole, but our entire economy is based on these businesses that aren't going out raising VC capital. But it's appealing, it's sexy, in the tech scene.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I find it really, really odd. Like obviously we spoke earlier about it. Like, it's a good news story, right? You know, it's easy to write the headline, you know, yeah. Vinny raises 10 million. Good man, Vinny. And he's off to the races. Whereas like, if it was like, you know, it's a very less of a sexy headline going, Vinny is in debt to 10 million and now has to exit for 200 million for him to make any money. It's a very different thing. Is this changing though? There seems to be a bit of an about face in the last couple of years. Is it changing, or is that just something I'm perceiving?
I think it's definitely, it is changing. I'm seeing like a lot of these like indie developers or indie hackers on Twitter building these businesses that are rightly, you know, showing as successful when they're hitting, I don't know, a few, say 50,000 MRR or being worth, you know, sub 10 million. Like that is successful for this, especially for an individual person running this business.
It's life-changing cash. Like it's crazy money. Like.
Absolutely. Yeah, we don't have to go out and change the world. That's not a critical, you know, that doesn't have to be part of your goal to make something as life-changing.
I always find that so funny. Like, it's like this thing, like everything has to be I'm going to make a dent in the universe. Calm down. Calm down, Sean. You're building B2B SaaS software here. You know, it's not going to fundamentally solve world hunger here.
Yeah.
Just maybe just build a good business for yourself. Why is it? Why are people afraid to say that? Like, why are people afraid to go, yeah, I just want to build a really profitable business?
I don't know. Do we not? I mean, do we just not know about it? Is it just not common enough that people can see that it is a viable path? You know, I don't know. Are we not teaching this in school and universities? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's strange because, as you say, like every business that fuels our economy, every shop, every barber's, every factory is run on, but build it for one, sell it for four. That's how we run our business, and we do that every single day. There's no big whoopla about it. Like, there's no like, oh, a big exit plan here. What was your plan when you started? What did you want?
Yeah, we wanted to build, our goal with Optus Thing up until fairly recently was to build a business that could eventually run itself. And we just step back a little bit and, you know, get a very good income annually on it. That was kind of our long-term goal. And that was from the start. It was like, let's just build something that makes us some money.
That's too logical, Vinny. That's not going to fly.
I know it is, isn't it? It's like for me, and then for me personally, it's more about like myself, Andy and Taddy are real kind of like no egos, and not we're not here for like yachts and stuff. That's not what our goals are. For me personally, it was all about getting to a level of comfort and kind of understanding when enough is enough with the business and, you know, the financial aspect personally of the business. I have no pension. I had no savings. My entire gamble and net worth and bet was in this company. So it had to have some level of success. And I always knew there would be some outcome that would be successful. It's nice to actually confirm that.
Yeah, you seem like a very cool customer. I can't imagine you and the other people getting too excited by many things. So talk to me then about the early days of, like, at what stage, you said you were working another job in parallel to building this. What were you doing?
Yeah, I was kind of consulting mostly. So in London, I was consulting for like a little kind of startup incubator where we're trying to build a few different apps and stuff, which was really fun. Then when we moved to New York, I was working for a gift kind of enterprise gift giving platform. At that time, I think Optus Thing was doing probably $15,000 a month, maybe something like that.
Which is sizable money, like.
Yes, and decent amount of money. We hired a few engineers at that time, so it was, there wasn't a lot of money. We weren't necessarily running operate our profit, decent amount of money. And then kind of over a few months working there and uplisting, getting a bit more momentum, I eventually managed to leave that job, which was in summer 2019. So that's, it was 2.5 years.
That's not easy, right? That's the bit people don't talk about. That's the bit where you're like juggling two jobs for 2 years. People get fed up after 12 weeks of, oh, I've done it for 12 weeks now. It's just... hasn't gone viral. Or it's like when people say, oh, I'm going to start a podcast. I'm like, just beware, podcasts do not go viral. They're a slow grind. They're the exact same as building a business. I think that's why I like it. And that's why I'm, happy to do the misery, because I'm like, this is a grind. And I know not many people will keep the grind up.
Totally. And I remember thinking, like, working weekends and stuff, that was an advantage. It's like, I'm working extra hours here that my competitor's not doing. So, we're going to make it. It's a long process, a long grind. And I think a lot of people would have given up, and maybe, if I didn't have my entire bet on this, I probably would have given up earlier. But you just have to plod through. And it's just enjoyable. I really enjoyed it. Myself, Andy and Taddy, catching up every Sunday, solving problems, seeing how we, find customers, building some really cool product. Like, it was fun. It was really enjoyable. And this is mostly pre-kids. I kind of went full-time up this thing just as my first son was born.
Nice. Good timing.
Entirely, yeah. So,
good timing.
Yeah, I know. My wife's like, what?
How hard can it be?
Yeah,
it's right.
Yeah, how hard can it be? Just one more thing on top.
Talk to me then, though, about the balance of the remote work. So you were all, the three of you were all remote from the start, were you?
Yeah, from the start, we set up in London. Myself and Taddy were living in London, and Andy was always working remote for the previous company from Leeds. Then I moved to New York. Taddy moved back to Slovenia, where he's from, and we were just entirely remote. Always were remote. There was no ever a thought of having an office or anything like that. It just never even crossed our minds, and we've been remote since. And I got married in 2017, and Andy and Taddy went to my wedding, and until the summer of last year, we haven't met up in person again, which I think is quite funny or remarkable, because I talked to these guys nearly every day of my life for 5-6 years, and we haven't been in the same room together until we all went to Slovenia in the summer to meet up.
That is class. It's also wild. It's a sign of the times that we live in, but that's class.
Totally. Yeah, it was. Whenever I tell anybody that, they're like, what? "That doesn't make any." Is that right?
giving a quick crash course then in remote work, because people are still struggling with this. Like, I talk to people like every week, and they're like, "Yeah, we're still trying to figure this out. Like, we just can't get our heads around it." Like, so give me kind of some of your kind of like learnings from this, because I think it's still like people are still can't get a good flow going.
Yeah, I think. For context, we have like 30 in our team. So our challenges of 30 is extremely different to somebody with thousands of employees or hundreds of employees. It's very, very different challenge. And for us, it's kind of down to who you hire, I think. We hire self-sufficient team members who, for the most part, are kind of left to their own devices all day long. Like, we don't. I think that comes from the engineering side. So our first five hired totally were engineers, and that's just the way engineering typically works, in that we'd have like a stand-up call in the morning, and then they go and build or they do whatever, and every so often there's a little meeting thrown in, but it's very meeting are not a core part of at least the way that we build product, and like the way most companies build a product. So that just kind of bled into how we dealt with everything from marketing and sales. It's like, here's what we want. You can go and figure it out and do it your own way. And then this is show us the result at the end, and we'll see how things are going. So very much hands off, and you guys go and do what you think is right.
How do you keep the train on the tracks in terms of like how many touch points would you have, say, in like a quarter or like a month?
Yeah, not many. So I would have a weekly catch up with all of the teams. That's one thing we would do on a weekly basis. We have an all hands meeting that we only introduced about a year ago when our head of operations, who came in and just solved lots of our challenges, and one of those was a all hands meeting. We'd have a weekly check in. One thing that we asked all of our teams was to do was to provide a weekly report, and then in that report we'd see what how we're tracking towards our goals. But we never had like we're hitting our goal this year is to hit X revenue or whatever it was. We had our only goal really was to grow at 8% month to month, or like 7% month to month. That was our goal. So we were always kind of reviewing that and what we can do to improve that.
So that was your North Star goal, essentially. That was the one thing everyone was working towards. Why 7 or 8%?
Because we were growing at 8%. It was a number that we could achieve. And, if you're thinking about if you're raising money or if you're going for an exit, the growth rate is critically important to that. That growth rate gives you top level multiples. That was it. Keep the growth going, keep the momentum going, and see where we end up at the end.
Kept it so simple. I love it. I think that's kind of the key thing is emerging here, is like empower the right people. How did you hire the right people, though? Because I think that's a big consideration. It's very all well and good saying, we empower everybody and all that. But how did you hire people that were able to be empowered?
Yeah, almost all of the engineers we hired, and we have, 10 or 11, were either people we'd worked with before or friends of people we worked with before, which is a huge advantage. I think it's we just knew what we were getting when we hired them. We hired a few, and we had the help of a company called Magical Teams in their base in New York, and they basically did the recruitment for us in terms of not like a recruitment agency. They would actually go out and do the initial interviews and then come to us with three candidates they recommend, and then we'd have a interview, you know, process with those three candidates and pick the one that we thought was best. So yeah, hiring people is not something that I have a lot of any of us had a lot of experience in. And with any aspects of the business where we don't have experience, we'll try and find somebody who can help us with that. And that's what we did with the hiring through that Magical Teams.
When you look back now, you've had a very logical journey, a very kind of like trial and error journey. Was there anything that would have shortcutted it a lot if you'd either avoided or implemented earlier?
Yeah, we probably the main difference I do next time around is move quicker on a certain aspect. So hiring quicker, spending money more, basically, is thinking what it comes down to. So we could have probably hit this revenue mark that we're at now maybe a year before if we had of being less cautious.
That's hard though, isn't it? Because when you're bootstrapped, that's difficult to kind of get your head around, because it's literally your money.
Totally.
You're spending money out of your own pocket, which is brilliant. Like I've never met a founder who bootstrapped that didn't have that really keen understanding of the value of a euro. So like, is that an experience thing, Vinny? Is that something you really have to go through? Like, you've gone through two now. Is that an experience thing? Because sometimes you can get told all the great information in the world. Like, information is not the problem. Like, we know you've access to every single person in the world now.
Yeah.
It's implementation is the issue. So is that an experience thing?
It is, you know, for lots of reasons. Like, number one, I've never built a sales team before. I don't know how to, I didn't know how to, you know, measure their success. I didn't know investing $1,000 into a sales team is going to result in $3,000 back, you know. But I know that now. So I know that I know how to structure performance targets for a sales team. I know that any money you put into a sales team is going to, you know, generate X back. And the one thing with the sales team in particular is that just an eye opener about how much of a machine it is. Like, it's you put effort in and money comes out. Like that's not how I understood it before, you know, we started doing that. So it's not something I just wouldn't have known that without the experience, for sure. And that's all aspects. That's sales, marketing, you know, acquisition in general, any acquisition channels that you're using. Just to once you know how it's working, it's just a machine, and you can just, you know, throw more money at it. Obviously, you need to have infrastructure in place, customer support, and everything else to be able to handle that. But it's an experience thing, at least for me.
That's a great insight. Like, and also, a good sales team can't override a shit product. So you've got to probably build it first into such a high level. Talk to me about Chanceplan, because I was dying to get back to this. You started your first founder with your mum.
Yeah. So a lot of my, you know, entrepreneurial kind of endeavors come from mum. So she, you know, what we'd call a side hustle now. She always had side hustles when we were growing up. She was a teacher in town. She was a home economics teacher in Donegal Town, in the AVS there. And she, all through my life, she had a tweed clothing store that she ran in the craft village in Donegal Town for a few years. She had she converted our garage into she had like 8 or 10 sewing machines in there, and the local ladies would come along and she'd teach them how to sew. So all these little endeavors that she had that really influenced me growing up. But she went on to set up a cookery school in Donegal, and it was in this cookery school where she effectively taught mums, mainly, or kind of local mums, how to cook healthily and on a budget, and how to plan for the week. So home economics, basically, is kind of what she's teaching. And she had this really a nice, successful paper version of how to plan your recipes for the week. And there was like a system to it, kind of like a, you know, not like Weight Watchers, but there was a system to it. Like, it was like that.
Like an original MyFitnessPlan kind of idea. She was on the kind of the app idea before an app even existed.
Yeah. Not related to fitness, but more related to just eating healthily and feeding your family. The fundamental of it. So we thought that was really cool. Let's try and put it on, you know, make an app or do it online. So I came along, and I've always coded, like, you know, front end stuff, nothing too complicated. But since I was like 13, I was obsessed with computers and doing that kind of stuff. So I was like, oh yeah, I can, you know, give this a go. And I always wanted to have my own business in this space, or in the kind of the tech world. So I started Child's Plan. I went through the New Frontiers program in the Edward's Ireland New Frontiers program in Sligo, Letterkenny, which was, you know, extremely helpful, and they provided some money to actually focus on something for, you know, 3 months. We ended up getting investment from Invest in I. So we moved to Belfast for a couple of years, got some investment from them, and kind of, you know, did okay. We were building a product, you know, learning all of these, you know, all the challenges you're going through, you're trying to figure things out. And in the end, it wasn't successful, unfortunately. But
what were you trying to build?
It was a resting planning software. Basically, yeah, it was consumer focused, where you would come in, and we had like a lot of really healthy, nice recipes that you kind of select a few of them into your week, and then you'd have all the recipes for a week, and they'd also be able to regenerate a grocery list that would then connect into Tesco or SuperValu, so that you can just get all of your list over there and then buy those ingredients.
When was this?
So this was 2013 or so.
Yeah, you're well ahead of it. Even though it was coming out now, I think it'd probably land. It's funny, timing is a wild one. Like, timing is strange.
Oh, totally. Time is everything. And again, staying in the game, if we just ran out of money, and we just couldn't continue. I think if we, you know, we could have plotted on, and it's definitely a good idea. It just didn't work out for us, unfortunately.
Great name as well.
But it was a massive learning experience for lots of reasons. That one of them was just understanding how hard it is to build a consumer focused business. And after that, seeing the potential of a business, B2B business through uplisting, was it's a completely different challenge. And it's one where, you know, with the B2B business, you can find your customers, and you can go to them, and you don't need that many of them to be successful. Whereas consumer is just, you know, you're building a brand, you're marketing, it's entirely different proposition.
That's like the kind of the bootstrap versus venture, isn't it? Like, you know, everyone, first-time founders are like obsessed with venture. And then second-time founders always trying to get it self-funded. And then first-time founders always go after a consumer because it's sexy, that's cool, and I'd buy that. And then second-time founders, nearly to a rule, always go B2B because you have all those insights going, I need to find 1,000 of these people, at least if I know I'm targeting printing companies in the UK. I know exactly where they are. I can hire a sales team. Yeah. Like, they're great learnings. Like, again, that's an experience thing, isn't it? Like,
totally. Totally. Yeah. It's just so hard.
Did you always want to go again?
No. Child's Plan ended, and the guilt of not being successful. The guilt of, it was mainly because we'd raised money and we'd done some crowdfunding, and having to tell everybody that it wasn't successful, like, it just weighed extremely heavy on me. And it's like, I just don't think I can do this again. But then started uplisting about a year and a half after that, so it didn't last too long.
There is a grieving period, though, isn't there, when something shuts down? Like, and it's very personal. Like, it's still cliche. It's not personal, it's business. It's both, really. Like, it is quite personal, especially if it's your first one or second one. You kind of do feel emotionally attached to it. How did you cope with that? What was your kind of process?
Again, really conscious after the non-successful exit. I can't think of anything that I did in particular to help to cope with that. I just felt shitty for, you know, a few months, and had to get back into work and, you know, survive again. So back into work and continue as normal.
Time to healer, all that kind of crack. What was it like then with the sale? Like, because was this on your radar? Because from chatting to you there, it didn't seem like this was something that you were going for.
No, not right now. As I mentioned, we were planning to, you know, step back. Again, this is the options thing, right? So it's like, we had so many options. We were like, we could sell, we could raise some money, we could just step back and, you know, get paid a nice salary on an annual basis, whatever it was. And just see what happened, really. Like I mentioned to you before we started, but with Shaz Plan, I spent all my time trying to raise money from people. Like, it was my job, effectively, was to try and get some money to go to the next step. Whereas with Uplisting, I didn't do any of that because I don't enjoy that. I don't like it. But what happened, you know, what's been happening the past couple of years with Uplisting is my inbox is just filled with people looking to either invest in the company or to buy it, which is like fascinating to me. It's like a total mind. It's like, what? So there's loads of, like, I guess through that process with Uplisting as well, I've learned that there's a lot of money out there to invest or buy good businesses, which is, you know, is an eye opener. But then selling Uplisting, I got a LinkedIn message in mid June, and it was from AirDNA, and I know AirDNA. I know that they're well respected in the industry, and I knew that they were backed by another well-respected PE firm called Alpine Investors in New York. So I took a call with them, and on our first call, I kind of explained, because I've had these calls before where they've ended up being like either a derisory offer or just not something that we were interested in, or, you know, full-on earn-out periods with equity in the company that's buying you. So in that initial call, we had just set out what we were interested in, and it's like, we're interested in cash at this multiple. And they didn't shy away from that. So that's kind of how that transpired, basically.
Did that confidence come from, came from your options, did it? Because you knew you were getting all these messages over and over and over. And it's you know, it's like if you pull a gun, like if you're going to pull a gun, you have to be able to use it. You knew, even if you didn't take the offer, happy days, you were having your outcome anyway.
Totally. Yeah. We've been talking to a few other potential acquirers as well. So there was like conversations going on in the background. This definitely wasn't, end of the line for us. We weren't desperate for this deal in any way. And even all the way through it, I was really conscious to work on the assumption that it wasn't going to happen. Like literally until the money was in my bank account, I was like, this is still going to fall through. I'm not, thinking ahead, which is good and bad, because when it actually happened, it was such an anticlimax. I was like, oh, I maybe I should have got a bit more hyped up for this because this is pretty cool. But yeah, it was very, very much, this mightn't go through. Let's just focus on where we're going.
It's funny you say anticlimax. Like, I used to ask the same question to everybody going, what did it feel like when you sold? And then I stopped because everyone used to kind of go, nothing. I'd be like, oh, okay. Air out of the balloon there. Yeah. But so for you, it's the same. It kind of felt like a normal day.
My parents were here, so it was lovely to actually have that time with them. And, you know, they were definitely more emotional about it than I was. But I think, and I guess this is the same with a lot of, you know, founders and people who've done this, is you put your entire self into this for years. Like, it's been 7 years working constantly on this. And you kind of, I said a few before, you kind of forget who you actually are and what you enjoy. And it kind of gets to the point where this exit happens and it's entirely life changing. It's like more than you could ever dream of. You have money in your account. It's like, was it just for this? Was it all just to have some extra numbers in my bank account? But I think it's more of just it's a process. It's going to take time to actually sink in. And yeah, it happened in November. So it's been a few months now, but still, yeah, taking the time to process.
Yeah, it must be hard because first world problems, obviously. It's great news, congrats. But I'm sure it is, yes, like, because it is the journey. Like, when I do this pod, like, it's important for me as well to have learnings from each people or each person I chat to try to take away something. And like, the one thing is, like, cliche alert, but like, people say enjoying the journey is something they really wish they'd done a little bit more. And it seems to be like when they do exit, then they're like, oh, yeah, that was a great experience. One thing that does come out of it is they just go again. So in the future, would that be something you'd look at?
I mean, I can't see how you couldn't do it again. Like, after all of that you've learned and all of the, you know, mistakes, but all the good decisions you've made, it seems too elitist not to do it again. I don't have any ideas yet, though. So I don't have any plans to do anything yet, but definitely we'll have to do it again.
I could kind of sense that in you, right? I could kind of feel like the energy bubbling up. Talk to me then about, like, you know, what does the future hold? Like, the next 6 to 18 months, what does that mean? Are you staying with Uplisting, or what happens?
Yeah, I'm around on, so basically the three of us are with Uplisting for at least the next 12 months.
Okay.
And that was separate to the actual transaction itself is like we're kind of founder advisor role with uplisting and AirDNA now. So it's all about my focus here is just making sure it's a successful transition and being, you know, sharing my expertise and understanding and knowledge of the industry from a PMS and channel manager perspective for AirDNA and working with the team and just being as much help as I possibly can be to make that, you know, successful.
On a personal level, then, is there anything you're kind of like looking forward to doing after the exit? Because obviously you've put 7 years of just everything into it. Like, is there anything that you'd kind of like promised yourself or anything where you're like, when that happens, I'm going to do this?
It's more like, my wife, Shauna, she's obviously this is not possible without you cannot build a successful business and have a, you know, a beautiful family without having somebody supporting all the way through that. And Shauna has like put a bet on me since 2008, I think it was. The ability to actually, Shauna was like an early investor in uplisting. So the ability for her to follow her dream now without any concerns is a huge, you know, reward for me as well.
Okay, that's nice. So it's for her, for both of you, really. Like, nice that she was an early investor as well. She gets to cash out and enjoy it as well.
Yeah. But like personally, it's the entire reason. I think one of my main goals for building a business like this was to just achieve like a level of just comfort so that I'm not concerned about money day to day. I can go and try different things if I want to do it. It's, you know, my family is secure. I can go and visit my family back home or abroad. Shauna's brother and sister live in Sydney. We only go to Sydney frequently. It's much more about those, you know, those experiences and things that are important to us. Being able to do those is a privilege.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've kind of identified as my kind of three goals. Like, it sounds a bit kind of like Instagram-y, but like to have like money freedom, obviously, time freedom, and location freedom. Like, they're the three things that are important to me, especially when you have a younger family and stuff. I think just being able to have that time freedom whereby, yeah, you can take her out of crash, or she need, you know, you can spend proper time with them when it matters. I think, again, learning from like people who've come before you, listening to them, going, you know, I really missed, you know, they were 15 and they looked around and they were gone, and you're kind of going, right, that's something I really want to emulate, you know. And I think like podcasts and all that are great, but if we don't start enacting the lessons, it's just procrastination. It's just entertainment dressed up as procrastination. Thanks for sharing that video. It was really refreshing. Not a lot of people actually kind of are honest and kind of go, "I want to enjoy my life, my family." Like, a lot of people kind of give a kind of a bullshitty answer about what they want to do, but like that's brilliant. Appreciate that.
Simple man. Don't have too many, you know, needs.
Well, that's kind of the theme I'm picking up from you from the whole way through. Like, you kept the simple North Star goals, remote work. Don't overcomplicate it. Just keep it simple. Hire great people, have a clear goal what you're doing, and just keep doing it every single day, and let that compound. Like, I'm always talking about compounding. Like, just, we overcomplicate a lot, I think. All right, we're going to do our quick fire round.
Totally. And yeah,
what book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
Oh, Jesus. This is a funny story, but we were when we were in Slovenia with this is the two line answer, isn't it? Sorry.
If there's a good story, Vinny, hit me with a good story. You've teased me with it now, so don't pull back.
So Andy, Taddy, and myself were in Slovenia, and it just happened to coincide. We're like, let's meet up for the first time in years and just hang out for a week and just go and, you know, drink some wine or whatever it is. But it just happened to coincide with this offer, and it was a few weeks into it, so it actually looked realistic. We're like, okay, this is interesting. So we went to Slovenia, and we were in like this beautiful area, like in the Dolomites, I think. Jesus, I hope that's right. And we just drove around Slovenia, and the whole time we drove around just checking out the sites, we were listening to How to Sell Your Business audiobook, and taking all of the lessons from that. We're like, okay, right, okay, negotiate on this part, negotiate on that part, do this, do that. Hopefully at some point you'll have to read How to Sell Your Business book.
I think that's what they call that, subliminal. Is it like taking it in by osmosis?
Yeah.
That's so funny. But isn't it weird though, sometimes like Things go in a weird circular motion. You end up back where you started in a good way for some reason. And
yeah,
not everything happens for a reason. We won't go full woo-woo, but like it is funny how things you just set in course just suddenly have a way of visualizing. What's something you had to learn the hard way?
I guess something I learned the hard way is it's, for me personally, I find it very, once I first started having like, pitches and stuff, you enter the startup world, you go for pitches, you have to go and pitch to investors, pitch to people who might, be a partner, whatever it is, very early days. I think I learned the hard way that isn't necessary. You don't have to do that. You can avoid a lot of that just by knuckling down and building your business. I learned the hard way because I spent so much time doing that with Shadow's Plan that if I had just focused on growing a business, maybe it would have a different outcome.
I like that. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Oh, my entire identity.
Deep.
Deep. I mean, genuinely, I think I feel like I've put my life on pause for 15 years almost.
Really?
That life. No, not, I mean, that's a bit over the top, but I've had it. How can I say this? Like my life on pause. It's more about, certain enjoyment. Like I find it hard to enjoy things and get excited about things, which I used to get excited about things all the time. And I think it's just about, it was a necessary. And that's why when we sold and it finished, that it was a bit of an anticlimax because it's like, you've given up a lot for this. But there's still a lot of time to find myself again.
You can come back, Vinny. You can find your way back. Yeah. Go find yourself. Have a retreat there. Your partner would be delighted going, I know I've just sold, but now I'm going to go on a 12-week retreat for me. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I would probably find a wealth advisor and put it in the American, in the US stock exchange or something.
S&P 500, everyone's, that's so hot right now.
It's easier. You don't need to, there's no, that's fine. You'll survive on that one, I think.
Yeah. That's solid, reasonable, good Donegal advice there. Take your 10% a year. Take that 8%. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner? Or this might be something for you. What's something you're going to start now that you've got everything back again?
Something I have done is I bought a coffee machine, which is top notch. Don't know how do they live without it. I don't know. But something I'd like to do is, a bit more time. I'm trying to get into it, but it's more just enjoying the time, the moment. So going for a walk, going to the gym, experiencing today, I guess.
I'm with you on the coffee machine.
No, waiting for the next day.
Yeah. I'm with you on the coffee machine. We got a Sage Barista last year. Life changing.
Yeah.
It's unreal. Like
that's the one where it does the milk and everything. Yeah.
And it's, I think when you have kids as well, when you have young kids, it's like, we'll just get to the morning and then we can have a coffee. You're up at like 3 a.m. and you're like, 3 more hours to coffee. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, and one of the reasons to be in, moving to Europe, as an American would say, is the more relaxed attitude and like having dinner on the street somewhere. I just relaxed, chill. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, well, I think you went to the right place. Lisbon's just beautiful, like the coffee and the food and everything there, and it's just a real nice space of life. We went there a couple of years ago, and I was just blown away by just how nice it is, how chill. It's just a real. It's kind of like if you're picturing a European chilled lifestyle, that'd be kind of where you'd end up. I'm going to give you 1 million euro, but you can only invest it in one person or one company. Where would you put it?
Okay, definitely. And I don't want to sound like a sap here, but Shauna, 100% into my wife. She'd run away with it.
Okay.
That is, it's something we are doing. I won't say that. So yeah, my wife.
Okay, interesting. Might have to do a part two, except it'll be with Shauna, not you. If you start a new company, I know you kind of half said earlier you wouldn't be sure, but if I usually ask people if you're going to start a new company in the morning, what would it be? Or for you, if you're still in that kind of mire of not sure yet, what big company do you think no one's building?
There's, okay, this is not in tech, but the challenges of going somewhere or spending, you know, it's very hard traveling with kids as a family. I find it so hard because what I want to do, I want to find somewhere that has a nice hotel and a kids club that is fully supervised for a significant period of time so I can actually chill out for a minute. But also like an affordable kind of country club type thing where you can go and there's loads of activities and you can spend a day out there where the kids are swimming. You might play around a golf or something. So if somebody was to build like the Soho house of...
Did you, I was just waiting to say it to you. Did you see that thread on Twitter the other day?
No.
Some guy went on a big, long Twitter thread about like, I just want someone to build the Soho house for families with kids. He's like, I just want high end. There you go. Connect with that guy. I'll try find this thread. I'll send it to you. Okay. That could be your new investment.
Right. We're on a winner here.
Yeah, it makes sense. Because it's unnecessarily difficult. You're kind of going, it's unnecessarily.
It is.
Because you're checking out all the things. We went to Spain last year. We brought the dog and the baby. So we double bubble. We were trying to check. Ironically, actually, they're more dog friendly than baby friendly. Like ever you go in Spain.
Yeah.
Amazing. Like we'd ring up a restaurant. We're like, just double check and we can bring our dog. And they're like, of course you can. As if we were like crazy. And they're like, of course. Like, it's brilliant. It's really cool over there. What do you believe that other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
No meaning to life, maybe.
Okay. I was going to say the bootstrapping versus VC, but we'll go with the no meaning to life, Vinny.
Oh, yeah. Can I do that again?
edit out no meaning to life. In your personal life, what's one thing you spend money on that brings you real immense happiness?
I spend money on immense happiness. It's not that it's like a little above normal. Like lots of things, like a little bit of luxury in a lot of aspects, I think, is what I like to spend money on.
I like it. What's your final piece of advice to every entrepreneur listening?
Final piece of advice, I think, is understand your strengths and weaknesses. So like what my strengths and weaknesses are and what I've used for uplisting may be very different to what yours are. And there's obviously, you know, I'm just talking about my experience, so yours might be very different. Don't spend too much time, I don't know, listening to advice and just go out and do it and talk to your customers and build a good product. And it's simple as that.
Love it. Vinny, thank you so much. Where can people learn or connect with you or learn a little bit more about uplisting?
For me personally, Twitter, and my handle is Breslin, Breslin. And uplisting is uplisting.io. Best place to find out about uplisting.
Brilliant. You were early on the Twitter game with Breslin.
Yeah, I got in there. I had somebody, some crypto bro there recently, who made loads of money and is also a Breslin, tried to buy it off me. But I was able to say, no, thank you.
How much did they offer you?
We didn't get into the numbers. Oh. It's like, I don't know, I might get kicked off even having this conversation on Twitter, so I'm not even going to start it. But we didn't.
I would have found out. I would have found out. Vinny, that was a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.